And I think that moving forward, a lot of these companies know, especially for neuropsychiatry, but anything really in neuroscience, these are the next thing. Like, there's been such a long time that they have not been putting money into this research, that this is really the next big category of neuroscience that I think will really push things off in the direction it probably should have gone in 50 years ago.
Welcome back to the Trip Report Podcast, a production of Beckley Waves, a psychedelic venture studio. This week, I'm speaking with Dr. Jacqui Van Somme, PhD, co-founder and chief scientific officer at Solera, a pioneering biotech company at the forefront of early stage psychedelic-inspired drug discovery and development for neurological conditions. If you've ever been curious about the intricate and fascinating world of drug discovery, this conversation is a must-listen. Jacqui walks me through the entire process, from scaffolds to IND submission, and all of the steps in between. Along the way, we discuss her background in natural product chemistry, the role of secondary metabolites, and a unique property of adaptive physiology whereby some types of stress actually strengthen organisms. We discuss the origin story of Solera and the inspiration from 2-bromo-LSD, a non-hallucinogenic compound that has been successfully used by people suffering from cluster headaches, among other neurological conditions. We discuss the increasing role of AI and computation in the drug discovery process, but also the chemical intuition that one develops after years of practicing chemistry. We dive into the emerging field of neuropsychiatric biomarkers, a toolset that has eluded researchers, clinicians, and patients in this particular field, and how EEG and other brain imaging technologies may be the answer. We also discuss the perception of psychedelic drug development in the eyes of the larger pharma world, and much more. And now I bring you my conversation with Jacqui Van Somme. I was down in New York this weekend. We recorded a bunch of interviews, and I came up with a good strategy there, and that is I want to surprise myself with the introduction and the, like, how we get started. And so the question that's coming to me kind of just off the cuff is, you're a scientist in, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the field of chemistry and natural products. And so I wonder if we just start with what does that field look like for somebody who has no conception of what that means. Can you sort of orient us to that field?
Yeah. It's funny because when a lot of people will say natural products, there are a lot of people that assume you mean just sort of these natural consumer products, like on the shelf, anything that's natural. Whereas historically for chemistry, natural products has always been compounds that come from natural sources. Mm. These are often compounds that the organism wasn't using for sort of its everyday metabolism or anything. Mm-hmm. These were extra chemicals that they used maybe to defend themselves or maybe to attract mates or just for all different reasons. It was almost like a chemical communication between organisms in its own right.
And do you mean mostly plants and fungi or microorganisms, like animals? Like, what falls within that category of organisms?
I mean, it does, at least when we're talking about it in the sense of medicine, which a lot of times natural products is around drug discovery and drug development. A lot of that has traditionally been around microorganisms like fungi or mushrooms or plants, but also marine organisms.
Oh, so interesting.
Algae, sponges, corals, that sort of thing. You can think of when you're underwater, you might not be able to be yelling or making a lot of noise at each other. So instead you just have this like chemical kind of communication going on. So it's all of those things.
Yep.
And it does have a bit of a tie back to a lot of what we know from thousands of years of humans trial and error of tasting or testing or eating things and hopefully not dying.
Yep.
And then seeing where it led us from there, which often led to a lot of different traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the chemicals or the compounds are not, I think you use the phrase like not involved in metabolism, but sort of more signaling, you know, predation and sort of like defenses or mating kind of signals. Is that right?
Yeah. So we call them secondary metabolites. So we have primary metabolites, which are more for me to just function as an organism internally,
yep.
versus what we consider these secondary metabolites, which would be, you know, for humans, it could even be something like pheromones,
mm-hmm.
or like the different smells that we probably all put off mm-hmm. that sometimes we might not notice.
Yep.
Those sorts of things where it's sort of a secondary mechanism.
And in the plant kingdom, for example, like a lot of those secondary metabolites are involved in defense, right? And sort of like warding off prey. So they're toxic to, for example, like lettuce or broccoli or something like that. I know is like, it just sits there, right? It's not going to run away from bugs or, but the secondary metabolites play a role of like warding off insects, for example, or is that right?
Yeah. A lot of times, as you mentioned, these are traditionally, if it's a broccoli,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really have this physical defense. Like yep. you said, it's interesting because then you can think of succulents or cacti with big thorns on them.
Yeah.
There are some that still have some of these chemicals, but there are some that when they have that kind of physical defense,
yeah.
they might not. So, and sometimes it can be to be that defense against certain insects but also against other things trying to grow in their space.
Oh, interesting.
So like if you're a plant
yeah.
and you have another plant trying to take over your spot, like vines or something, you might put off something to try to get them away. So it's a bit of a, yeah, it's defense a lot of the times, but there are instances where they actually want to attract like symbiotic.
Mm.
So there are some plants that really need certain insects or certain microbes to be able to function. And so sometimes it can actually be to attract that.
Interesting. So can I ask a question, like in terms of the defense mechanisms, I would think if some of these secondary metabolites or compounds are meant to be noxious or like poisonous to bugs or insects, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
but they're potentially helpful for humans. Is that?
Yes. Yeah. And that's the interesting part is in the way that they've been helpful, at least more traditionally, I'd say, when you think about maybe antibiotics mm-hmm. are a great example. The reason they're helpful is because a lot of times those organisms were also using those compounds to get rid of other microbes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So then we are using it really for the same reason.
For the same purpose.
Right. Unfortunately, it does then typically kill a lot of the microbes in your body,
right.
sometimes beneficial ones, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's usually enough to at least get rid of the main infection to help you. So sometimes it's for a similar mechanism like that.
Oh, interesting.
That we got that information. So aspirin was originally from salicylic acid from the willow bark
mm-hmm.
and willow tree. And it was traditionally used by different indigenous people would chew on it when they had a toothache.
Oh,
to help with sometimes like tooth pain.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times it was those kinds of observations of seeing unique instances where maybe it helps with pain,
yeah.
but maybe at a high enough dose, if we were a tiny little organism, that could be more toxic than it would be to us
right,
as humans.
Right.
So it's all about dosing, really.
It's all about dosing. This is kind of where I was hoping to get to. So there is a time in my life where I was really obsessed with the concept of hormesis and the biphasic dose response, because to me, it explains so much about beneficial things that have become in vogue lately. Like, you know, you think about sauna use or people who are going into the cold to like stress themselves. Basically, it's the idea that like a stressor at a high enough dose that could be lethal or detrimental mm-hmm. or damaging at a lower dose actually activates, you know, innate repair, rebuilding processes. And so like the classic example is weightlifting, right? Like at the molecular level or the cellular level, like lifting a heavy enough weight will kind of create micro trauma in the muscle fibers and the tears. But those tears are what turns on all of the genes for hypertrophy and strength development and rebuilding. And I think that's a very elegant idea. And it seems like everything that is like old, you know, every kind of health practices like fasting or plant medicine or herbs or, you know, thermal, you know, sweat lodges or what have you, seems like they apply that principle. You know, acupuncture, yeah. I think, is another one where it's like it applies that principle. And, you know, obviously thousands of years ago, people didn't understand the physiology or the biochemistry of it. And I think there's also like an element of that in like psychology or emotional regulation, like confronting a challenging situation, a painful memory. Like those are kind of often like the pathways to growth or healing or what have you. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I think it's all encompassed, I guess, in that statement of like no pain, no gain. Mm-hmm. A little bit. Not to say that all of these things have to be painful,
right,
necessarily.
Right, yeah.
But that you are adding some sort of element, like you said, of a stress or some other thing that does almost require then your body to figure out how to heal itself.
Yeah.
And it likely does tie back to even your immune response, right? And your inflammation or inflammatory responses.
Right, right.
A lot of these things we don't understand super well, at least from especially the drug development or mm-hmm. Drug discovery side, is really the interplay of all those things. I do think that there's a lot of unique elements of more traditional and older medicine, like you said, where we may not understand why it seems to help,
yeah.
but it does seem to do something.
Why don't we take this into the next port of call that I wanted to touch on with you, which is drug development and drug discovery. And I'm wondering if you can talk about your work at Celera and what you got cooking over there.
Yeah, so we've been largely focused on the tryptamine class of psychedelics. So really mm-hmm. your psilocybin, psilocin, or DMT, specifically DMT, we don't do anything with 5-methoxy DMT, but we really wanted to work on finding ways to make those compounds more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that at least as traditional compounds, they have a lot of promise, whether it's depression or other aspects of maybe mood disorders. But we really felt like some of the hallucinogenic effects might deter being able to use it for other types of populations.
Mm-hmm.
So our focus with the company was, okay, is there a way to remove some of that hallucinogenic effect, but still maintain some of the positive benefits that we see with these compounds? So it was really taking that, what are natural products, right? That came from different natural organisms, modifying them very slightly,
mm-hmm.
not huge, very small modifications so that you're not losing too much of the activity, but you're hopefully just finding a way to maybe reduce some of that hallucinogenic, as well as there's some other things about them that aren't always so great, right? Like depending on if someone already has high blood pressure or heart issues, then they may not want to be on these things.
Yeah.
So how could we find better ways to make it more accessible beyond what we think the traditional psychedelics will help with?
And so when you say making minor adjustments to it, can you talk about what that process entails? Is like, are you in a lab, with a lab coat and goggles and glasses on, mixing beakers and stuff like that? I have a visceral reaction to like memories of chemistry lab in college where I hated it, but I loved chemistry, but hated the lab, So, or are computers doing that all now? Like what does that look like?
No. So, I mean, we do use computers to help sometimes with like the initial, what are we looking for? How do we assess these things? Like, what are we looking at? We do use computers to help sometimes with that design aspect of like what kinds of compounds we might want to design. It's a little bit of a mix of both more of the human intelligence and experience working with machines a little bit to really mm-hmm. come to those conclusions. But then once you have the thing that you want to be making, it is a lot of lab work. So we have two brilliant synthetic chemists at Celera that work on all of that. So if my mind or their minds come up with some wild compounds mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. unique things, then they can bring those things to fruition. So they're really, I'll give them all of the synthetic chemistry credit. My side is more so on the design of the compounds
mm-hmm.
and even sometimes on the formulation. So like, how are we going to deliver this
to patients? Right.
But they definitely are the masters of building the actual compounds in the lab.
Let me ask you this before I sound like an idiot. What is a scaffold? What is meant by a scaffold?
Yeah, so you can think of a scaffold like you'd think of a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you have a base sort of blueprint or generic model that you want as like the initial start. And a lot of times this will be a building block that helps keep activity in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to build off from that to try to create new compounds. But it's really to help us, especially with like patterns, to understand, which types of scaffolds do which types of things in the body. Mm-hmm. So if you're making really small modifications, yeah, then you're not, depending on honestly who you talk to, you're not always changing the scaffold, but you're just making these small, more minor modifications. So everything we work with for the most part is still in that tryptamine category, which might be the scaffold.
Is the way to understand tryptamine as like a molecular scaffold, or like a, is that one way of thinking about it?
Yep.
And so then there's different kinds of tryptamines based on the permutations of hydrogen bonds or different chemical structures. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. So you have, especially right now, between whether it's DMT, 5-methoxy-DMT, psilocybin, you also have a DIPT, which is diisopropyl tryptamine. They all seem to have slightly different effects. Mm-hmm. For people, but they would still, at least from a chemistry perspective, fall into that tryptamine category.
So they're tryptamines, and they're impacting the 5-HT2A receptor primarily, but they have a different sort of subjective experience.
Yeah, and then they do hit other receptors,
right?
Which is a big part of it is that they, I think I've probably totally overused this metaphor now at this point, but I relate it to when you're playing like a musical note on a piano. Mm-hmm. It's just you're rarely ever just playing one key at a time.
Yeah.
You're usually trying to play a full symphony. So it's that idea that a lot of these compounds hit different types of receptors, even beyond 2A, in different ways, which often leads to those
different effects. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And so when you're thinking about drug design, so you're kind of starting with almost like the inspiration of it, your sort of starting place is DMT or psilocin or psilocybin, and then adding or taking away or modifying the atoms in their location and their direction and their structure. And so do you come up with like two or three or like a couple thousand? Like what's the order of magnitude when you're kind of doing that?
On the computer, I mean, sometimes it's billions, you know, it depends on what you're doing on a computer, but when you're actually,
wait. So sorry, you start with a scaffold. I wish I could have a better language to describe it, but then there are billions of potential permutations based on that scaffolding.
Yeah,
there can be. So it's really, that like changes everything. That's like a real needle in a haystack to find something that.
Yeah, it's molecular Legos, really. I mean, that's what you're trying to do. And so you can think about just how many different ways you could organize the same 30 Legos. Like if you had, you know, and that's the idea, is that if you have all of these carbons and hydrogens and different atoms, all you have to do is move their placement slightly, and that's a new compound.
Yeah.
So you can end up with, millions or even billions of compounds, depending on your library. And that's in the computer, though, virtually.
Yeah, right.
But once you're actually trying to then synthesize it, that's not trivial. And I think a lot of people want that part to be a lot easier than it often is, because they'll say, oh, we have millions of compounds in our virtual library, we're just going to make all of them. And it's like, that's going to take a while. So
interesting.
Then we usually narrow it down from there. Like we'll use the computer to help us narrow down the most selective, like we call them hits, but compounds that we think will be active in the way we want them to be active. And then our synthetic chemist and myself will look at them and we'll say, okay, does this seem realistic? Do we think we can even make this? Because sometimes computers can come up with stuff that's just not even going to happen in the lab. So you have to also assess the reality of actually creating those things. So to date, at least for us at Solaire, we've made probably 60 to 70 compounds now. But you have to create the synthesis for every one. So
that's not a trivial matter, it sounds like.
No. that was what, you know, the Hoffman and Shulgins of history were just doing. So I always joke and tell our chemists, I'm like, you guys are just that new generation. You just need to keep making these things.
So there's some element that kind of helps you get from billions to 60 and 70, right?
Yeah.
And is that intuition? Is that art? Is that some logic or rational decision-making? Like, what does that process look like?
There is a decent amount of what we call chemical intuition that I consider fairly artistic to that process that we have not been able to put quantitative measures to have a computer do it. It really does take certain synthetic chemists to be able to look at these things. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain amount of logic too. So like we can at least narrow it down quite a bit based on if we really want the molecule to be active at like the 5-HT2A receptor, the hallucinogenic sort of psychedelic receptor, then we can initially screen all those compounds. We call it screening, but really you're just testing them all in that receptor to see if it looks similar or not to known compounds.
Wait, sorry. I'm sorry. Say that again. You can take those compounds and screen them with that receptor. Is that like in a petri dish or is that?
No. This would be on the computer.
Got it.
To help narrow down which ones you then want to synthesize.
Got it. I see.
So you use the computer to kind of do a lot of different virtual testing,
yeah,
we call it. And then based on what it comes up with, we then usually select the ones that are the easiest to synthesize initially, to be honest. Mm. Because there's a little bit of like a practicality mm-hmm, to it mm-hmm. too, of which ones do we think we could make a lot of with a pretty simple synthesis yeah. rather than let's go for the most complex
Got
compound
it.
Ever.
Got it. So you have an initial screening process, then you synthesize a bunch of them. And then what's the next kind of layer of screening or test? And if any of this is like, hey, dude, I can't talk about that. This is like proprietary stuff. Like, I don't know where the boundaries are. So you'll just have to stop me.
No. This is pretty generic, like drug discovery okay. stuff. Like this is kind of the path of what most should be at least going through.
Got it.
When you you do that initially, then you synthesize the compound.
Yep.
And then that's when the petri dish comes into play. Like Got that's it. When you'll have the different receptors and you'll actually test them in the lab and experiment whether your compounds activate or deactivate those receptors.
Got it.
And then from there, you know, you'd then say, okay, all of the compounds we've now tested in the actual petri dish, which ones had the best, depending on what activity you're looking for, mm-hmm. which ones had the best activity?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's usually when you'd start to jump to things like, okay, let's look at maybe neuronal growth, if we're talking about, you know, psychedelics or neuroplastogens, like let's assess whether or not they do have these neuroplasticity or neurogenesis kind of effects. Like how are they changing neuron growth? Or you can also go right into animals with those compounds and see how they're affecting animals.
Interesting. So you're in the petri dish and you're evaluating the, I think it's called the binding affinity, right? Like a binding, mm-hmm. whether it's like agonizing or antagonizing, but then also there's a potential to look at the effect of the cell itself. Like, is it growing, yep. changing shape, sprouting dendrites, like that kind of thing?
Yep.
Oh, that's super cool.
You usually do those things separately, but you can do all of them as your way of seeing if it really has the effects you want it to have.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah.
And so what's the next step?
So once you do that, I mean, the typical animal studies at first are usually mice or rats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you want to make sure first and foremost that you're not having any
negative
side effects, yeah. right? I mean, you can also do that beforehand. Some labs will do, they have like screening in cells to see if you see any toxicity, if you want to do that before going into animals. And if you don't see anything there, then you'll do the animal studies. You want to make sure they're not getting too sleepy and lethargic. You want to make sure that you're not seeing any weird behaviors that seem toxic.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to do those assessments, but you also could be looking for things like anxiety or depression
yeah.
or, you know, these models aren't perfect.
Yeah.
I won't pretend that they are, but they at least are an initial
sure.
test for you to be able to do, because you can't really just go out and ask people to start taking your drug when you've
right.
never put it in animals.
Right.
Not all of us can be Shulgins and Hoffmans who just decide to synthesize things and try them.
And share it with their friends, right?
Right, and share it with their yeah. friends, which is good. I mean, it's definitely risky when you do those things. Yeah, so then after animals, I mean, you kind of determine where you want the compound to go. So a lot of times by the time you're in animal studies, you've only got a few compounds now. You're not mm-hmm. talking about the tens or
yeah.
hundreds or anything anymore. You know, you have a few single maybe compounds. And then depending on how the animal studies go, that could help you determine what indication you want to go after. Is it depression? Is it anxiety? Is it Alzheimer's? Is it addiction? You know,
mm-hmm,
where are you
mm-hmm.
focused and where do you think it has the best chance to help patients? And then that's usually when you do all the safety and toxicity, and then you try to get it into clinical trials.
Got it. Got it. How did Solera, what was the initial idea? What's the origin story?
Yeah. So my co-founder also has a PhD in chemistry, mm-hmm. background of natural products, drug discovery. So we had really looked at all of the different classes of psychedelics, and we just, based on all of the data, psilocybin and DMT really had what we considered the most unique activity, but also the best safety profiles. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to go for a more safe option. So we knew we wanted to start with those, but what was a big inspiration for us was actually a 2-bromo-LSD, which is, there's another name, BOL-148, mm-hmm. in the literature, because it seemed to not have the hallucinogenic effects of LSD, right? But they were still looking at it for things like migraines, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. that could be helpful without yeah. the hallucinations. And they actually did quite a bit of studies with people, I think in the 50s maybe, and they really had great outcomes. So we figured, well, that base blueprint or scaffold of LSD is pretty similar to a tryptamine. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can make some similar modifications on tryptamines to have a similar outcome. So that was really our initial, I say, like R&D moment, where we were just researching and diving deep into the literature, figuring out what things we thought were possible, and then just really trying to move forward with that. But we definitely had a big inspiration once Spravato or esketamine was approved, mm-hmm. because we really felt like some of the stigma around the compounds yeah. was being lifted, yeah. but also the amount of work they did on the mechanism and how it actually works was pretty helpful. So we really thought that was a good sort of platform for us to jump off.
How so? Because Spravato is a ketamine enantiomer, and ketamine, as I understand it, it's an NMDA agonist, right? And is that a tryptamine or?
No, it's not a tryptamine. It's actually one of the few that's not even based on a natural product. It's right. actually a purely synthetic compound. It's actually more similar to PCP than it is to any other structures.
Yep.
So it does have that difference in the receptors it's directly targeting, yep. but some of the downstream effects that has on your body and in the brain are linked. So it's still part of that. I think we actually talked about it before, but the biomarkers of like BDNF and
right,
some of these other
right.
neuroplastogen
Got
kind
it.
Of effects, the glutamate burst, like a lot of these, and beta arrestin's a big thing people will talk about. They think that there's a similarity between how they're working.
Got it. So the yeah. work that was done there in terms of what's happening at a molecular level and kind of downstream effect is helpful for other non-ketamine.
Yeah. Like even the
compounds.
Neuroplastic effect, like
right,
seeing
right.
the neuronal growth and looking at some of that, like the cellular models, like all of that gives us a good reference now
Got
for,
it.
You know, what things we might want to target.
Very yeah. interesting. So at this stage, like, do you have to whatever degree you're able to discuss it, like where are you at in the process and how, what's like the latest developments that you're able to share from Solera?
Yeah, so we do have a lead compound mm-hmm. Right now. So that would mean it's gone through just about the whole process up to the animal studies
yep.
that I mentioned. And we've tested it in a few different areas. We had a bigger focus on things like anxiety, neurodegeneration, and addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were more focused in those areas. And so that's really where we're focused on this compound. We do have quite a few others that we've now tested in animals, and we have some good data on, but our big focus has been on this one lead compound. About the most I can say is that it is when we talk about scaffolds, it's going to be most similar to like a psilocybin derivative.
Interesting.
It's not a prodrug, it's not a deuteration or anything like that, but we did modify it a little bit more than that, but it would be based off of a psilocybin.
And when you say a prodrug, psilocybin is a prodrug of psilocin. Is that
yes.
the right
yeah.
way to understand it? Right. And so a prodrug would be something that is different from psilocybin that then turns into psilocin after all of the
Correct.
Processing and metabolism in the body, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because we wanted to have it be non-hallucinogenic. So some of the changes we made make it so that when we test it, so the model usually in animals is a head twitch model,
or something.
We call it for mice,
yep.
right? There's a few others, but that's the big one. So
did you tell me about zebrafish? Or was that... that I, somebody no. else.
I know there's somebody who's working yeah. with those, but we haven't. Okay. Mm-mm. Yeah. I have worked with them in the past for pain and like
interesting.
Epilepsy.
Interesting.
That was a big area with zebrafish for a long time, but I have not done it but ours was mostly mice. Mm-hmm. And based on those outcomes, we believe it's going to be non-hallucinogenic and that it still has some of the benefits that we wanted to see with it.
Yeah.
So right now that's really our main focus.
Cool. And so you'll take that into safety and toxicity studies. That's like preclinical. Mm-hmm. And then at that point is when you get to the point of submitting like a new drug app or no, IND.
An IND.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So once we get through, the larger animal and other safety and tox, then you can apply to get an IND to hopefully do a phase one in humans. Mm-hmm.
Help me think about the business perspective of drug development in this world. Like, my understanding is that the pharmaceutical industry has, I don't know what the natural evolution of it is, but like, there's obviously like several big players, you know, i.e. big pharma that are a lot of times they're not necessarily doing R&D, but they're acquiring kind of biotech startups such as yours that are either offshoots of academia or privately funded kind of projects that get to a certain point in the drug development process whereby like they feel pretty confident that they can take it the rest of the way. And somebody described it as such, like at each phase of the drug development process, sort of the value of the asset kind of increases. And there's a certain point where the risk of taking it yourself to approval versus getting acquired. Can you help me understand like how you think about that or what that landscape looks like?
Yeah. So I think it's a good one to talk about only because, I mean, there's a reason that we also wanted to target the non-hallucinogenic options. And a big reason for that other than accessibility was also because we knew that in order to get through things like phase three clinical trials and into commercialization, unfortunately, the way the system's built, that requires a significant amount of money. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars. And that will likely mean that some of these larger biopharma and, you know, pharmaceutical companies will have to come in to help support some of those things financially. They're not going to do that if it's a known psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just, I think this, even though some of that stigma has gone away, there's still a significant amount of it. You can see that when you look at some of these bigger companies in phase two and phase three, none of them have large pharma backing right now.
Yeah.
And there's, unfortunately, that's just how it is. So for that process, you really want to, I mean, depending on what kind of company it is, right? There are some companies that do want to raise the capital to get through all those clinical trials, to do the commercialization. That's a huge undertaking. I mean, massive. I think it's a valiant one, but it can be very difficult.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times, you know, companies like mine, where we're so focused on the science and the research, we really want to be generating the next classes of compounds that could be across a ton of different indications.
Mm-hmm.
And so that usually does, those are the types of companies that maybe these larger pharmaceutical companies, when they're looking for the next compounds that they want to work with, they would look to companies like ours to then help. Sometimes they might help fund it. It depends. There's a lot of pharma companies that have venture arms, right? That can help from typical kind of capital funding. There's other options where I think you mentioned where they might want to actually co-develop something with you and help fund it to a certain amount, but then they would take it on.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of options, to be honest. And there's a lot more companies than just the biggest of pharma, right?
Yeah.
Like there's some smaller or mid-size kind of biotechs that have a decent amount of money and interest that could also be part of that. So I think there's more and more interest in this field for sure. I think the last 6 months have definitely catalyzed quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
And I think that moving forward, a lot of these companies know, especially for neuropsychiatry, but anything really in neuroscience, these are the next thing. Like there's been such a long time that they have not been putting money into this research, that this is really the next big category of neuroscience that I think will really push things off in the direction it probably should have gone in 50 years ago.
Yeah. So say a little bit more about that, because I know you just got back from, I think it was a neuropsychiatric conference in Boston. That was a big one. And so me and a lot of our listeners are going to be navel gazers on the psychedelic space, right? Like so we live in a bit of a bubble. Well, I'll speak for myself. I live in a bit of a bubble where I don't really understand, you know, on occasion, you know, I talk to somebody who is completely outside the bubble and it's either like they look at me like I'm crazy or they heard about Michael Pollan's book. But like from the perspective of drug development industry that is, you know, investors, and what's your read of the landscape there?
Yeah, I was at they call it the Neuropsychiatric Drug Development Summit. Mm. And it does often have, you know, quite a few biotech and pharma companies there. I will say that some of the biggest names that most people know are still shying away from it a little bit, just because they know that some of the more psychedelic focused companies often are there.
Wait, so they're shying away from this conference in particular?
So because the conference used to be called Neuropsychiatric and Psychedelic Drug
Development Conference. Oh, interesting.
This year was the first year they took off the word psychedelic.
Interesting.
And it's because there is still a pretty large stigma there. And I agree with you, out within my bubble too, we'll talk about psychedelics all day and nobody cares.
Yeah.
But then you get out of that and you realize that there's still a lot of people who aren't as comfortable with that. So this was the first year they took that out. But I mean, you still have some pretty big companies attending. I mean, they had some representatives from like Biogen, AbbVie, like some of these bigger companies for sure. And some of the smaller, like mid-sized biotech. But what's nice is that we're all kind of in the same boat where nobody really knows how these things work, like in significant detail.
Mm-hmm.
We have certain receptors we like to look at. We have certain animal models, or what was actually a bigger hot topic at this was the imaging, like EEG and some of the other imaging that people are using to really help even more, because we don't really have good, what they call biomarkers.
Yeah.
Like what's something I can look for in people that's actually going to tell me what outcome I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And I think across the board, it doesn't really matter who you are. We just don't know enough to say, this is it. This is the thing we're looking for. This is what we're targeting. And that's going to give me exactly the outcome I need. So a big reason for that is because, so my background, I used to work in like infectious and tropical disease, uh-huh, antibiotics, that sort of thing. In all of those areas, you have a specific thing you're targeting because you're trying to kill it.
Yeah. It's a very clear target.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah. Whereas in this case, I'm not trying to kill anyone. I'm definitely not trying to destroy their brain. So I'm trying to, you know, find the best way to assess what you're changing in someone. So
oh, that's interesting.
I would say that was the biggest takeaway for sure was, and I gave a workshop on biomarkers for that reason, to just help kind of emphasize how little we really know and how much more research really needs to be done. And I think that's a big part of why some of the larger pharma and biotech companies haven't come in any grand way, is because they still feel like some of the initial research needs to be hashed out.
I want to ask you about that presentation you gave on biomarkers, but I'm also drawing a blank on the phenomena. Earum's Law is what it's called, right? Where, do you know what I'm... Earum's Law is like the opposite of Moore's Law, which apply. So Moore's Law is like, you know, computer chips will double in capacity and half in size every 2 years. And it creates this sort of like, yes, exponential kind of curve in like chip capacity. That's probably an awful description of it. But the inverse of that is that the cost and the time of drug development has kind of gone by the opposite, right? Like over decades, like it's gotten harder to bring new drugs to market. It's gotten harder to discover new things. And I mean, this has kind of been, I think, what you were just talking about, like this is scaffold, maybe you would call it, as kind of this neuroplastic agent is a new mechanism that is unlocking, perhaps, I mean, hopefully, knock on wood, reversing a trend that has left us with very little innovation in the domain of neuropsychiatric drug development and neurological conditions. So I think that there's a lot of promise and a lot of hope. And I just think like the fact that psychedelics, these stigmatized and politicized and, you know, wildly mind-altering compounds are like the thing that will reinvigorate the drug discovery industry. Like that, I don't know. I guess I had to just like kind of pause there and sort of have a sense of awe, because that is really like wildly fascinating that that's the situation that we find ourselves in. So.
Yeah, no, I think it will though. I think that it's definitely requiring people to be curious about it.
Is that on account of the capacity to create neuromodulation or neuroplastic changes? Is that how you see it? Is that their capacity to reduce inflammation? Like,
yeah, I think all it's, of it's it? All of those things. Yeah, but especially now over the last, I want to say decade or a little bit more, especially on the inflammation side, that's just been a huge, I mean, whether you're looking at, you know, cannabinoids or terpenoids or, you know, now in the, which from cannabis, or if you're now looking into some of these psychedelics or other molecules, there's a lot of different, and there's other natural medicines too. I mean, don't get me wrong, that are in that category. I just think that for whatever reason, cannabis and psychedelics really forced it on everyone in a different way, where they said, we don't understand what they're doing. We're trying to get these to people, but the way that our current society and culture works is that that was not possible in a direct way. So then now, because we really honor and respect a lot of that scientific and research endeavor, maybe if we start to really try to understand how they work, that might help us be less fearful of them.
Yeah.
And so now you've got this whole big shift into wanting to understand why they seem to help people. And it just keeps tying back to things like inflammation or like maybe in for psychedelics, neuroplasticity and the immune response like that. We still don't really understand a lot of aspects of like even autoimmune conditions or other aspects of the immune system. So I think it's just raising a lot of questions and showing us what areas we still lack a lot of rigor from like a scientific perspective. And if we want it to be that, then we're going to have to do a lot more work to figure it out. Because it's not straightforward.
Yeah.
Like other things.
That feels like a natural segue into the concept of biomarkers. And you mentioned neuroimaging and EEG as tools there. So give us the high level overview of your presentation in this area.
Yeah. So my side of it was, since I am a chemist and I just pretend to be a biologist when I talk about biomarkers, my side was definitely more focused on maybe some of the genetic aspects or what biomarkers we might see that we're looking for when we talk about a compound changing the chemistry of the brain or what those different mechanisms are. One of my colleagues that was helping me run the workshop was more focused on the EEG side because he is a psychiatrist and he works in the clinic. But at least as far as I'm understanding it from the EEG and imaging perspective, it actually does a really great job of teasing apart the placebo effect. And so you can imagine now, at least with my company, we're trying to remove hallucinations, which was one of the few things helping you with the placebo effect in clinical
trials.
Right. So something like EEG and some of that imaging can actually really help you understand if you're still causing similar changes in the brain without necessarily having maybe the hallucinations and having it be different than placebo.
Got it.
That was probably the bigger area of interest. But also, we struggle with translating from animals to humans a lot. And you can actually do EEG on rodents. And there actually is a decent correlation, depending on what you're looking at, between those and humans. So if you're they do have differences in their brain. Like, it's not identical, obviously. They don't have a prefrontal cortex technically, so like that makes it a little bit weird, but they still have been doing a lot more research to tie some of the outcomes you're seeing in the animals to what you might see in humans, because we just need a better link. Like, when we're doing all these animal studies, we really need a better link to know what's going to happen in humans. And so that was really what the main inspiring like talks were on EEG, which is because we can get pessimistic very quickly on the fact that we don't know a lot, but let's focus in on what we do know. And I think that I'm a big proponent for the fact that things like psilocybin and DMT have fairly good safety profiles. Yeah. We've now known over the last few decades too, what types of safety things we need to look at. So I think that it's good, even if we don't necessarily know exactly the mechanism they're doing to work, we know what things to avoid, which can honestly be almost just as important when you're talking about like safety. So
will we see, and perhaps this is already the case, like tools like EEG being incorporated into clinical trials as either primary endpoints or teasing apart the placebo effect versus like, is that happening or is that on the road to happening?
Yep. Yeah. It's already starting. I mean, a few have used it or are currently using it. There's also quite a few companies out there now really promoting it to be the company that you'd like go to, you know, use their software, use the EEG, show the outcomes, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think there were probably two or three companies at the conference that actually work with this and are really trying to propose it to different pharma companies to help with different aspects of clinical trials. So it definitely seems to be on the rise. I mean, there's a lot of interest around it. Yeah. So
it also seems to be this technology that feels like it's been around for a long time, you know? And I mean, I'm familiar with it, or I associate it with EEG neurofeedback, right? Where you're sort of like create, mm-hmm. you know, the process of neurofeedback, which is also like a technique that feels like it's been around for a long time, but has been hamstrung for either, I can't figure out if it's efficacy or if it's just like clunky materials that sort of are tough to scale. But that is another sort of tool that seems like, you know, there's probably a lot of potential with it, but for one reason or another, it hasn't.
Yeah. I think the technology has been easier to, even just from like a materials and what the design would be and like computing power and mm-hmm. a lot of these other things, I think have just gotten significantly better in the last 20 years, mm-hmm. making this a lot more feasible on a larger scale. Because that's usually what people were concerned about was, how am I going to run?
Yeah.
A phase 3 trial on hundreds or thousands of patients with this, like, it's not going to work.
When you got to put on like a whole bunch of like sensors right. on the head and it takes forever. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that part of it has also been like the scalability and the technology itself getting better in that area. So, I mean, cause you are taking in a lot of data points too, whenever you do these mm-hmm, things, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's not quite like fMRI or anything, but like, it's still a lot of information. And I think now that we've had a little bit more time to start using it and to start validating it.
Yeah.
Like that was a few, you know, there's been years there too of people just needing to really validate that it actually does anything. So I think some of it has been that process mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. I mean, it seems really interesting to me though.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you can help really tease out that placebo effect, like that's huge for any class of molecules,
right,
not just
right.
these. So, yeah.
And that's important in psychedelics because psychedelics are kind of challenging to blind, if not impossible, right, at higher doses. But my understanding is that in the domain of like neuropsychiatric and even pain, like the placebo effect in clinical trials is a very confounding factor, because I used to run clinical trials in independent like CRO, and I thought like the quality of care that somebody would receive in a clinical trial is probably the best care you'll ever get in the modern American healthcare system, because, you know, you're followed up. You have like basically a study coordinator is somebody who just makes sure that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, checks in with you. You know, there's all these visits. And so that could really boost the placebo effect, just that human contact and the whole process of it. And so is the idea that a mechanistic effect could be distinguished from a placebo effect based on the signature of brain imaging? Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But I think that you're absolutely right. Like, if you are really receiving a lot more of even just human connection in any way, especially if you're talking about neuropsychiatry, that could really adjust how someone's feeling when they're taking in all the questionnaires of, are you feeling good today? And
right.
it's like, well, yeah, I feel great because I have awesome human contact
and
I'm getting taken care of. So I think that's a really good point to make, is that that can really affect everything and the outcome. So yeah, that would be the hope, is that it can help kind of tease that apart from these other like brain signatures happening from the medication. Yeah.
There's actually, as a quick tangent, I went to acupuncture school like 15 years ago. And part of the reason why I felt it was intellectually defensible was this research that used fMRIs in evaluating the outcome of a treatment. And so the challenge is that the placebo group responded, but the real group had changes in the somatosensory cortex associated with, this was in carpal tunnel, so the changes in the representation of the hand and the arm were different in the real acupuncture group, but not in the sham acupuncture group. So it was kind of an example, I think, of what you're talking about, is where clinically the outcomes were the same. And that has been historically the challenge in evaluating so many different sort of interventions, acupuncture among them. But when you kind of look under the hood, so to speak, and sort of see the mechanistic changes there, it was like, oh, wow. Which kind of begs the question is like, well, what is reality? But I'll step away from that. But you know what I mean? It's like, it kind of has a really, really far reaching questions that are kind of bordering on philosophy.
I think some of those VR groups are trying to tackle some of that.
Yeah.
Like working with some of the virtual reality. I would be interested in seeing those sorts of assessments, like whether it's EEG or something mm-hmm. similar, whether it's they're looking at virtual reality, but also I would just even, they talk about it with yoga, right? Yeah. They talk about with meditation.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these things, whether it's acupuncture or not, like there have been decent studies showing that you still have some of these outcomes, including neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if there's a way to tap into some of that and see what, you know, is really happening, whether it's those types of models or whether it's a drug that has to help somebody, like I think that there's a lot of options and a lot of opportunity for people to help heal themselves as well. It just really depends on the indication and what you're trying to target, especially in our case, things like neurodegeneration or addiction. I think that there are very rare cases where someone can really just help themselves out of those situations with some of these other things.
Right.
But for something like depression or anxiety, I do think that there's still a lot of promise there. But that's a big reason that people are, at least in this field, if they're in clinical trials, they're usually targeting treatment-resistant depression or major depression for that reason, because they think that although some of these things can work in certain instances, if you're sort of beyond that potentially, you might need some kind of drug to help.
So, it, for example, in MDMA-assisted therapy, which is the furthest along in the drug development process, and hopefully we'll see approval sometime next year, it's MDMA-assisted therapy, right? So there is a wraparound support, psychological support therapy before, during, and after the therapy, right? And I think the Compass Pathways and USONA also includes what I think they would call it psychological support, not psychotherapy. But my sense is that, let's just take psilocybin, for example. There's also research on pain and I think pretty preliminary research on neurodegenerative diseases. Like my sense is if there was not a drug development industry, this is a hypothetical, right? And we just had psilocybin that's growing out of the ground. The innovation that would be most meaningful would be like on how you support people given the intent that they're, you know, they're after. So somebody with mild dementia would be supported, and kind of the adjunct wraparound support therapy would be different than somebody who is seeking to, you know, resolve a substance abuse disorder, right? Is that part of your thinking, like the concept of like drug-assisted therapy, drug-assisted, you know, neurofeedback, drug-assisted intervention, you know what I mean? Like, to me, it feels like there's a potential for combinations of drugs plus, again, an intervention that could drive meaningful change in specific directions depending on the indication. Do you think about that at all, or is that sort of too messy for your process?
No, I mean, we have to think about it. I mean, especially depending on the indication you're looking at. I mean, in the case of neurodegeneration, they often already have some type of assistance, depending on where they're at in the process of that disease. So in that case, you might already have a situation where they have some of that assistance. But for something like neuropsychiatry, I think that if you're targeting any kind of anxiety, depression, PTSD, you know, any of the above, you have to think about the therapy and the psychotherapy component. And I think that that's really what's making a big difference right now in those fields, is that you do have that joint effort mm-hmm. between those two sides. I think that there's a huge human component. I think that from a mental perspective, that can be very helpful to even just have any support mentally in any situation. Now, that being said, there have been studies where they've shown that people with these types of indications were just as benefited from just having friendship. So when it was found that if they were on something, that even just having a friend to almost talk to, or even just a person to talk with, regardless of whether it was a therapist or a psychiatrist, even that was found to be hugely beneficial.
Yeah.
So I think there's an aspect of, again, that human condition, I think, there, where you just want interaction and human interaction and talking and conversation and that sort of thing. Now, how that then gets tied into drug development, you know, I think that's the big question, right? Is how do we do all of these things? And does it need to be actually part of the therapy? Does it have to be FDA approved along with the therapy? Or is the assumption that if you're working with someone that's already has a psychiatric condition, that they would be with a therapist, or that a therapist would be part of their life?
Right.
I mean, we even think about it, even though we're creating non-hallucinogenic compounds, that just means someone might not need someone to be watching them the whole time, worried about maybe a negative outcome.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they might not need somebody there to help talk to them through whatever their brain is going through.
Right.
That's what they do right now with transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Oh, really?
You know, if you're doing any of the work with psychiatrists or psychologists in that area, they often want to make sure that they're working with you so that when you have those neuroplastic kind of moments,
windows, right?
You're in a positive space so that you don't just then go into a really negative space and just almost negate all the work you've done.
Interesting.
I think anybody working in this space has to think about these things.
Yeah.
I think you can't just sort of write it off as it's fine. I think, you know, we're, again, in the, if it's neurodegeneration or addiction or some of these, or headaches, let's say like cluster headaches, you know, some of those areas, maybe not. It kind of depends on what you're targeting.
There's like a spectrum of like a purely biomedical, you know, all the way through like psychosomatic and sort of very complex. And so,
With addiction, I mean, you might still want to think about it, just because I think even though things like Alcoholics Anonymous maybe don't have the greatest percentage of success, I think that one of the things most people will tell you if they've been through AA is that they did like having a sponsor.
Yeah.
They liked having someone with them that they were able to go to in the moments that they had the urge, which is the biggest issue.
Yeah.
So I think you still have to think about it, but it's just whether or not you want to make it a requirement. I think that's the big question is, you know, when you're trying to get a drug approved, you already have to jump through so many hoops.
Yeah.
Do you also want to add that on as a requirement?
Right, right. Yeah, I felt like there was a recent couple months ago a comment from the FDA about psychedelic trials, and I'm having trouble remembering the specifics of it, but it felt like there's two angles to it. On the one hand, the psychotherapy or adjunct kind of therapy could be a confounding factor in terms of like understanding efficacy and where the signal is coming from, but like common sense and communal wisdom sort of points to the fact that like that is an important part of it. And so, you know, for the purposes of just like getting regulatory approval and kind of clean data, it can be, you know, viewed as like a negative thing. Whereas in like clinical practice, you might say it's probably a benefit. It's not unlike the placebo effect, actually, right? Like where like in clinical research, it's actually like a pain in the ass, but in clinical practice, you want to maximize the effect of the placebo effect to the best you can.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I think it was the like draft guidance that they put out.
Right, for
things. Yeah, that came up actually at the conference too. And everyone was trying to say, hey, just remember, it's just a draft. So everyone should try to talk to the FDA to give their comments and let them know how you feel about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see kind of where they go with some of that.
I want to start to land this plane here and see if we can finish up with looking ahead, you know, 20, 25 years or some undetermined time in the future where this class of compounds has made its way into the clinic. What does the future look like as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, so I guess I'll tell you what I hope the future looks like, more so than what I actually think like might be realistic or not, just because that's not as fun. What I would hope that the future looks like is as these start to become FDA approved, that it completely shifts just the mindset around how a lot of these things are treated. That would be my hope for the future, is that then it's almost like the norm that you have some kind of system where you're very well supported for mental health. It's already part of that process. You now, maybe you do have a drug associated with it, but you've also now shifted that paradigm so that there's a huge psychological and mental health component that everyone's way more aware of than they were right now, or than we were even 10 or 20 years ago. That would be a big hope of mine. I think that there's going to be a lot of different approvals of a lot of different kind of drugs, but I would say my biggest hope would be that it would just really open up the mindset of what those opportunities are, mm-hmm. and that there would just suddenly be so many options for someone that they would be able to decide what the best option is for them, because it's different for everybody. Yeah. I think that that's the, I don't want people to go to their doctor and just instantly be thrown on SSRIs.
Yeah.
I want like that future to be, okay, you go to maybe a primary care, or maybe you already have a psychiatrist or psychologist or coach or anything that you're working with that would tell you, here are all of the options you have.
Yeah.
And let's see which ones work best for you.
Yeah.
And which ones you respond to the most. Because you're really just talking about the human condition at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be different for everyone. Everyone has different traumas, different upbringings, different things that affect them. And there's just not going to be a one size fits all. And we already know that.
Yeah.
So that would be my biggest hope, is that it would just really open up the mindset of all of these different options, and that there's not necessarily one that's better than any other, but that there's a lot of opportunity for people to try to get better. That's probably my biggest hope out of the whole field, whether it's drug discovery or whether it's psychedelics or anything else. I think that that's all you can really hope for.
Yeah. What's coming to mind, and this is maybe kind of more, I'm curious about your personal aspirations, because it feels like there's a potential for like transdiagnostic kind of treatments, right? So like we were just talking about, like the same compound could have an impact on, you know, Alzheimer's or chronic pain or treatment resistant depression, or, you know, we could hone in on like what makes each one of those unique and kind of find increasingly more and more sophisticated solutions, you know, from like a chemical physiological perspective. Like, is this where you're going to be spending the rest of your career, do you think? Like, it feels like there's a lot of work to be done here, and it's just the beginning, and it's super interesting. So
yeah, I will probably be like an old lady scientist someday, still like trying to work on these things. I think it's because it's so intriguing, right? Like, we still don't even know what consciousness is. So like, I'm a scientist. I can pretend I know all I want, but there's a lot of aspects that are just so unknown that I don't think my curiosity would ever be diminished.
Yeah.
The more we find out, the less we know, right? So I definitely plan to spend the rest of my life working on these things. I enjoy it. I'm passionate about it. I've had a lot of familial ties to neurodegeneration and addiction, mm-hmm. so and mental health. I mean, everybody does, but me in particular, my father passed away from dementia. My sister struggled through alcohol addiction. Most of my family did. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 4 years old with my mom. So I think that just for me, from like a personal perspective, I don't plan on going anywhere. This is kind of where I'm hanging out. But I will say one area I would also like to see this make a big impact is palliative care, like mm-hmm. end of life care. Mm-hmm. I think that especially after watching my father he struggled for about 10 years, I think, after his diagnosis before he passed away. Like we kind of just like shun people to die now in our society, unfortunately. And I don't agree with that on a moral, ethical, or any other way level. I think that there's a much better way to help that transition for people. And I would really hope that, you know, psychedelics in general, but even just anything that's working on like neurological conditions or anything else will help us really understand how horrible our system is right now for end of life care, and how much it needs to be shifted. So back to what you mentioned about support, I think that if we're talking about supporting mental health and we're supporting these other avenues with some of these clinical trials in place, I would hope that that support also then translates to other areas, so that we can just really, really see a big shift there.
Yeah.
I think it's worth the time, it's worth the research, and it's worth figuring out.
End of life anxiety or depression, I mean, from a drug development perspective, because there is like the right to, there's a case, you know, Ames versus the DEA right now that's in the courts that is seeking to create access through right to try for psilocybin. Mm-hmm. But from a drug development perspective, Is that an approachable market? I don't know. I don't see anybody working in that domain, or maybe I'm missing it.
You mean for like end of life?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, it's not really like a diagnosis. Like, I get someone's dying.
Yeah. So it would be if someone's like diagnosed with a terminal illness, basically. And the right to try. We have that in Florida too. There's a lot of veteran groups pushing for it.
Yeah.
Especially in that, really trying to push some of the right to try act, whether it's for end of life or more so in those cases, sometimes it's a addiction or PTSD and other, you know, mental health conditions. But I think the big area is around, you've been diagnosed with a terminal illness, what can you do?
Yeah.
And so I think that if there is, you're right that it's not a single diagnosis, there's a lot of terminal illnesses out there, but I do think that it should be able to fall under its own category of like what we've now defined as like a terminal illness. And, you know, what that timeline looks like, what that indication looks like, and then opening it up to be able to have people live out the rest of their days in a state that they want to be in, rather than just sort of like deteriorating slowly or being put on morphine.
Yeah.
So I think people have the right to make that decision for themselves. I think it's a little bit inappropriate to say that anybody should tell someone else how they're supposed to die.
It's also like, to get a little bit meta, like there is a phrase from, I think it's ancient Greece, that I learned about through Brian Muru Rescue's book. It's like, oh God, now I'm going to forget it. Like, if you die before you die, then you won't die when you die. Kind of alluding to the fact that there is something to be glimpsed and the mystical experience potentiated by these compounds have the capacity to allow people to glimpse that and thereby alter their perception of their life and the meaning. So And also, like, we're all terminal in some degree, right? Like,
exactly.
You know, so like, where's the cutoff?
We're all heading that direction.
Yeah, exactly. But where I was going to take this is like, it's one of these things, you can rip on modernity or a Western society or modern society for a lot of different ways, but it is tragic how we treat people at the end of their life right now, or how the system and the incentives have kind of aligned for that to be the case.
Yeah. My mom's an end of life doula.
Oh, wow.
I think a lot of people don't even realize that exists, but there is a big group of people in that space that are really trying to help, you know, make that more manageable. But I think it's still an area that definitely deserves our attention.
Yeah.
I guess is my main point, you know, it deserves it. And I do know like anecdotal situations where others that were diagnosed with different aspects of stage 4 cancers, that these types of things were the only things that really got them through the chemo.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so whether it was cannabis or mushrooms or otherwise, right. I think that says a lot. Like, if that's regardless of if we know how it works, it seems to help. And we've been able to do enough assessments of the safety and toxicity of them over the last few decades to know that.
Yeah.
That's not a huge concern. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Especially compared to cancer medication. Like, I think we're,
chemo
is a lot more toxic for sure.
There's a crazy asymmetry in terms of risk and toxicity when we're talking about, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Accepted.
So either way, it's just, I think it deserves looking at for sure. And I hope it does. That would be part of my, when you asked about the future, that would be part of my hopes for 20 to 25 years from now.
For sure. Well, Jackie, I really appreciate your spending time with us and telling us about your career and your work and Solera and your thoughts on the field. It's always eye-opening to connect. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks.
And this is like the cliche end of a podcast. Where can people find your work and you on the internet?
Yeah, so I'm usually on most social media as J. Von Salm. I think you can find most of mine through that. But for Solera, the majority of them are just the name Solera, which is Silera. And we do have a website, solera.com, if you ever want to, you know, sign up, and we'll contact people with updates.
Cool.
We don't contact people very often, so don't worry about that. But that's most of our spots. And I think you can find out what we're working on, what we're doing.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to follow along with your journey and see where it goes.
Thanks for having me.
Cool.
Yeah. Thanks, Zach.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for listening to the Trip Report. We hope you enjoyed it.
You can sign up to receive our free newsletter and get the podcast sent directly to your inbox by going to thetrippreport.com. This podcast is a production from Beckley Waves, a psychedelic venture studio. If you're interested in learning more about building companies in the psychedelic space, head over to beckleywaves.com to get in touch. If you like this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and share it with your friends. I'm Zach Hegney. The Trip Report is produced by Cooler Production Company with coordination from Caitlin Jabari. See you next time.